I want to thank you all for coming on the first of the Saturday afternoon sessions. I really appreciate it. Bill and David and I were thinking, well, you know, I guess the three of us, we could talk to ourselves if nobody shows. So I want to thank you all for coming. Just in case, if you need to know, you are in section 610. We are not alone, perspectives on international copyright. I'm Heather Briston, and I am the chair of SAA Council's Intellectual Property Working Group, and I want to thank you for coming to this session today. I think you will really enjoy it and really learn some fascinating things that are going on in archives and in intellectual property all over the world that affect us. I want to begin by I'm going to introduce both of our panelists. David Sutton is going to speak first, and then Bill Maher is going to follow him. And then when we're done, if you could please hold all of your questions until the end. This session is being taped, so at the end, I will be repeating your questions and all that. So I'd like to introduce first Dr. David Sutton. He has been the director of research projects in Reading University Library, England, since 1982. He is the editor of Location Register of English Literary Manuscripts and Records and the UK editor of the Watch Copyright Project, Writers, Artists, and Their Copyright Holders. He was awarded the Benson Memorial of the Royal Society of Literature for Distinguished Services to Literature in 2002 and the Archivist of the Year Award from the Scone Foundation, New York, 2006. Within the International Council on Archives, he is the chair of the Section for Archives of Literature and Art and also of their Working Group on Intellectual Property. He has published extensively on literary manuscripts and on literary copyright, and his other interests include, and this is the part that I found fascinating, food history. He is a contributor to the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cookery from 2009 to 2012, and he was involved in local politics. He was the labor leader of the Reading Council from 1995 to 2008. In June 2012, he was elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, and he has, however, reluctantly retired from playing cricket, but still plays soccer and badminton each week. And one of his objectives in coming to San Diego has been, with the help of many of us, to try and understand how baseball works. So thank you very much, David, for coming and sharing with us what you know, and I hope you learned a lot about baseball. Our second speaker today is going to be Bill Maher, as known to many of us. He is the university archivist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and a past president of SAA. He is a member of the SAA's Intellectual Property Working Group and a member of ICA's Committee on Copyright. A regular speaker on archival administration and copyright law, he is the instructor for SAA's course Copyright, the Archivist, and the Law. He recently represented the SAA at the World Intellectual Property Organization's Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights. So thank you very much, and David, I'd like you to start, please.
Thank you very much, Heather, and I'd like to repeat Heather's thanks to you all for being here. My job is to be the warm-up man for Bill Maher's account of what he did on behalf of SAA in Geneva. I'm going to lead off with some reflections on national differences and the need for international cooperation in the world of copyright, starting with some thoughts on national differences, and not travelling too far from here, just to remind you of some of the differences we find in our near neighbours here. So the copyright period in Mexico is 100 years after the date of the author, and it's something that is occasionally being referred to in court cases in this country, so it's increasingly something that we need to be aware of. If judges are tempted to say that there can be cases when the longer period applies, then having a 100-year copyright period just over the border is something that American archivists in particular need to be very aware of. I believe that the Mexican period is the longest period in the world, but it's only one ahead of the Ivory Coast, which has a copyright period of 99 years for some reason that is unknown to me. Just looking through those countries on the slide there, I can tell you that the copyright periods in Guatemala and Honduras are 75 years after the date of death of the author. That's the former Mexico period as well. Belize is 50 years, El Salvador 50 years. Nicaragua and Costa Rica have adopted the standard 70-year period. The period in Panama is 50 years, and so on. You get the picture. Just off the slide there, or running off the slide into Colombia, the copyright period in Colombia is 80 years, which is the former Spanish copyright period. I'll just pause and move away from that map just to pay homage to Spain, which, as far as I know, is the one country in the world which actually reduced its copyright period in 1987 when they moved from an 80-year copyright period to a 60-year period. So it can be done. Unfortunately, the European Union later obliged them to move back up to 70. I'm going to look at a few more case studies just to exemplify national differences in copyright duration, and this is from my own area of literary manuscripts. Firstly, the celebrated case of Marcel Proust, out of copyright in his own country in France. And because most countries apply the Berne principle that an author should not enjoy greater protection in another country than they enjoy in their own, all the European countries and all the other countries in the world that I know, apart from the United States, assume that Proust's works are in the public domain. However, because of the United States has a view that it should apply its own regulations regardless of nationality, and so the one country in the world where works by Proust, which were first published after 1923, remain in copyright is this country. So Proust, United States only. Conan Doyle is a similar case, but with differences. He died in 1930, which means that all of his published works, all the Sherlock Holmes works and so on, are out of copyright in the UK and hence in all the other Commonwealth and European countries. However, his copyrights since 1923 are vigorously and rigorously protected in this country. His unpublished manuscripts are out of copyright in this country, but remain copyright protected in the UK because of a strange quirk of UK law that I won't trouble you with. Lorca died in 1936. You might think that that means that his copyrights have ceased to apply in Spain and the European countries. It's not quite so, because Spain has a particular regulation which allows the estates which create a foundation for the public good and place manuscripts and other artifacts within those foundations to have an extension to their copyright period. So Lorca remains in copyright in Spain, but not in the rest of Europe, and also in copyright in the USA because of the particular post-1923 rules here, and probably, for all I know, also in copyright in Mexico and Colombia, and just possibly the Ivory Coast as well. Herman Charles Bosman died in 1951. He's South Africa's most famous writer of short stories. The South African copyright period is 50 years. What that means is that Bosman is out of copyright in his own country, and consequently all the other countries which apply the rule that you don't give more copyright protection than in the home country. So as far as I know, the USA is the only country in the world where Bosman is still copyright protected, and that may apply to unpublished as well as to published works. Rabindranath Tagore, copyright period in India is 60 years, unusually. So Tagore came out of copyright in India and other countries in the world in 2002. The USA is the only country where Tagore may possibly be still copyright protected. And finally, died in the same year as him, Virginia Woolf. Her copyrights have expired in the UK and Europe under the 70-year rule, but are still vigorously protected in this country under the post-1923 legislation. On the other hand, once again, her manuscripts remain in copyright in the United Kingdom, but not in the United States. So we have the strange position from an archival point of view that the Virginia Woolf manuscripts in New York Public Library are in the public domain, but the Virginia Woolf manuscripts in the University of Sussex are still copyright protected and will be until the year 2040, if you can believe that. So that's enough, and probably more than enough, on national differences, but it emphasises the point that the essence of copyright legislation remains national, and there's a temptation for each country to devise its own regulations. If you read through the copyright regulations of various countries, they are very different indeed, and they have all sorts of quirks, the Spanish foundation law and so on, which can be unique to the particular country. I'm going to move on now to look at the reasons why the need for international cooperation is now more pressing than ever. International cooperation began probably in 1886 with the Berne Convention, which started to introduce principles which could be shared across legislations, most notably in the area of the minimum duration of 50 years after death, but with a whole range of other potential shared legislative approaches to intellectual property. And since Berne, there have been a number of other international treaties on copyright which are gradually starting to emphasize the fact that nations need to cooperate on intellectual property issues. We have more and more things in common. We can't allow a continuing situation where every country potentially has its own quirks and variations and so on. And above all, the arrival of the internet has made it clear that there needs to be forms of standardisation, and that requirement for standardisation is driven not only by users, archivists and librarians, but also by the business community. Seeking for an example to illustrate that, I reminded myself that the copyright period in the Yemen is 30 years after the date of the death of the author. Then I cast around for an author who died around about 30 years ago, and I came up with Henry Miller. So I guess that one fact that probably not many of you knew coming into the room, but maybe you might be inclined to remember as you leave the room, is that Tropic of Capricorn and Tropic of Cancer are in the public domain in the Yemen. Now, it may not be a great business risk at the moment that somebody might open up a Yemeni website and publish the whole text of Tropic of Capricorn, but there is that possibility there, and the different legislations that feed into the internet drive not only ourselves and our communities and our users, but also the business community into a strong requirement for international cooperation and standardization. Above all, in the world of exceptions and orphans, we were discussing this matter at the SAA Intellectual Property Working Group earlier this week, there is a real risk that as everybody becomes more aware of the issues around orphan works, individual legislations, individual initiatives will all be set up in lots of different countries and will diverge from each other. And the need for international standardization and harmony and cooperation, particularly in these areas of exceptions and orphans, is stronger now than ever. The World Intellectual Property Organization is the copyright organization which makes those deliberations possible. Bill is going to talk more about that shortly, so I won't say more. Within the world of archives, it's the International Council on Archives which potentially provides the international umbrella under which these cooperations, discussions, and attempts to formulate international cooperation can take place. So just a quick word about the International Council on Archives. It regards itself in that way, rather grandly, the voice of archives on the world stage. The most important single fact about the International Council on Archives is that as of this month, it has 199 countries in membership. So an archival organization which has that range of membership. It's organized by a system of sections and branches, sections by type of archive, and branches to cover regions of the world. But the coverage is extraordinarily complete, and it does provide a possible linkage to organisations such as this one to enable international cooperation. It functions as well as sections and branches through a series of working groups, and one of the working groups which has recently been set up is the Working Group on Intellectual Property, established in 2010, which it's my pleasure to be the chair of. So I can bring the range and the membership of the International Council on Archives into cooperation with the with SAA in our joint future working on intellectual property and copyright issues. One of the things that the new Working Group on Intellectual Property of the International Council on Archives has done is to try to establish what are the key issues within copyright which matter to archives worldwide. And we've produced collectively, but with a single author, a publication called current issues in copyright for archivists, which is available through the ICA website, and which runs through a whole range of relevant issues for archivists, starting with the reasons why we have to be aware of rapid change that are going on at the moment, the new kinds of protected works that are coming onto the market, the expanded terms of protection which we're seeing in various different areas, the changing jurisdictions worldwide, and above all, in the area of our being in an information society, the notion that content is power within that society is explored within this paper. The paper then goes on to look at some of the key issues which Bill will be talking about shortly in relation to the work of WIPO in Geneva, exceptions and limitations for libraries and archives, an important piece of work on exceptions and limitations for disabled users, and exceptions and limitations for education and research. So this paper on some of the key themes from this paper on current issues in copyright for archivists are there for all of us to share and to participate in and to comment on. Please do send your comments. Do look at that current issues publication and send us your comments about your own working experience with copyright. We are going to discuss further in Brisbane in a couple of weeks' time the international perspectives on copyright and how we can continue to expand and work together. And Bill and I again are going to report back at that meeting about some of the international initiatives that have been taking place on behalf of the whole archival community. I want to finish this introduction by just stressing that there's a tremendous role within the world of intellectual property for the two organisations, this organisation, SAA, and the International Council on Archives, to work more and more closely together. SAA brings a focus, an intellectual content, an ability to really formulate ideas with great clarity, which, frankly, ICA doesn't have. ICA's strength is not the same as the strength of SAA. ICA would never produce a document of the clarity and the content that the ICA document on orphan works, for example, brings. But what ICA offers is this huge range of membership worldwide. So there's a terrific opportunity for partnership between SAA and ICA in copyright working. We have a working group on intellectual property. You have an intellectual property working group. We're very, very close together. My final thought on this is that we should continue to be working together through SAA and through ICA to ensure that there's a distinctive archival voice which is being heard, not the same as the voice of librarians, not the same as the voice of the other interests that have been coming to the table for many years in discussions about intellectual property, but a distinctive archival voice now starting to be heard in Geneva in two or three distinctive forms. And I'm going to hand over now to one of those archival voices, Bill Maher, to tell you what he's been doing on our behalf in Geneva. Bill, over to you.
Okay, well, congratulations to all of you for having made it all the way down this hallway to this session. I appreciate your attendance here and hope that you had a sufficient lunch and caffeine to keep you going through what may be a hurried-paced presentation of the crazy world of intellectual property right formulation internationally. Archivists nowadays seem to have a lot in common with tightrope walkers. Our archives exist to be used, but in order to deliver content to users in a professional and ethical manner, we have to balance the goal of providing access with consideration of individual rights, especially privacy and copyright. After all, we are stewards not only of the physical documents, but also their intellectual content. Because the intellectual content is governed by the Berne Convention for the Protection of Literary and Artistic Rights works, every local archives is inevitably drawn into the orbit of international copyright. It used to be that copyright in what we might call the analog world provided a limited monopoly with certain exceptions that served society pretty well. Now, however, with content owners seeking to extend copyright into the digital world without any of the exceptions that existed in the analog world, archivists find our mission more and more circumscribed by ever-expanding copyright restrictions. Because copyright's policy is increasingly driven by international treaties, at the same time as today's network environment gives our collections a global audience, archivists must work internationally to address copyright policies that impede our mission to connect archives with the public. That's why it's in this area that archivists will find the levers needed to gain the international uniformity for exceptions and limitations in copyright, even if we can't do something with the variations in term coverage that David outlined so eloquently. Unfortunately, many policymakers at that level believe that the economies and society of the world will crumble if the private monopolies of authors and their agents are not guaranteed by governmental intervention, with norms set internationally by, for example, the Berne Convention or the 1996 World Intellectual Property Organization Treaty. These instruments provide the broad outline of copyright and authors' rights, although they do allow countries to legislate some exceptions, such as for use in quotation and education. But the areas for exceptions where the exceptions can be created are overshadowed by treaty provisions that impede archival work increasingly. For instance, the 1996 WIPO treaty requires national laws to enforce copy protection mechanism, making migration and preservation of electronic records very difficult. Non-U.S. archivists may face an even more difficult challenge. The notion of moral rights found in the Berne Convention dealing with the investment of an author's personality in his or her creative works. So-called moral rights allow an author not only to claim authorship, but to object to the distortion of a work, or even to withdraw it or keep it unpublished. In many cases, in many countries, these moral rights continue after death and are considered inalienable and irrevocable. Given the broad scope of works covered, the long duration, and the sweeping rights granted to copyright holders, copyright inevitably will affect our stewardship. Thus, it's imperative that we not only have a solid understanding of copyright policies, but also become strong advocates on the archival dimensions of copyright. After all, we don't have a built-in lobbying group to help us, such as the publishing industry. The general public and even most research users have no idea how much the law, which was written originally for a print world, prevents them from taking educational advantage of the current networked environment. They just think we archivists are dragging our heels. It is copyright law that stands in the way of archivists pushing a few buttons to make our collections readable worldwide. Unless one is willing to skirt the law, the rules, if we want to follow the rules, deprive us and our users of the most revolutionary communication tool since the printing press. It will take significant changes in international understandings to improve the situation. Yet, as a small constituency, we are not in a strong position to compete with the large interest arrayed against our interest. And neither the public nor our users are ready for the political work necessary to change the balance away from a system that fails to serve their needs. However, if we are to be true to our core goal of making the past usable for the future, we must exploit the moral credibility that comes from our basic mission and advocate for changes. There are global actors, fortunately, with whom we can collaborate. Thanks to 2004 and 2008 initiatives by Chile, Brazil, Uruguay, and Nicaragua, there's been a call for WIPO to develop a treaty language requiring member states to enact international laws, exceptions friendly to education and economic development. Recently, the ICA commissioned a copyright working group. As David mentioned, they also issued this white paper on current issues in copyright for archives and appointed the UK's Tim Padfield to serve as ICA's representative to WIPO sessions in Geneva. Thanks in part to efforts from the International Federation of Library Associations, IFLA, there's also the possibility of a WIPO treaty to create an international standard for all countries to institute exceptions to copyright's exclusive rights. These so-called library and archives rights were the subject of a special standing committee on copyright and related rights, SCCR, meeting in Geneva in November 2011, followed by another session just last month. WIPO's SCCR is the body authorized to draft language for international treaties on copyright. The agenda for its November 2011 session included multiple days on proposals for an international treaty for library and archives exceptions. With funding from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, SAA commissioned me to attend that SCCR session as an official NGO observer. Many individuals and organizations over many years have been involved in moving the issue to this point. And from what I observed last November, it may take many more. That's because SCCR functions unlike almost any other professional, academic, or policymaking body that I've encountered. It's a world where even what to call a document has the potential to wipe out 2 weeks of work, worth of work. One imagines that deliberations at WIPO's Geneva headquarters would be dramatic, include dramatic happenings on important matters, but last November's SCCR revealed that things actually proceed at a glacial pace. The drama, although important, lies elsewhere. Against the backdrop of differences in global economic development, the national delegates respond to the competing interests of consumers and copyright holders. In general, developed countries, or the so-called global north, have a stronger stake in the content side, while others, the global south, with education and science needs for their development, have greater interest on the consumer side. In addition, SCCR acts only on a very specialized meaning of the word consensus. Nothing is adopted by SCCR so long as there remains even one dissatisfied delegate. With every delegate thus holding a virtual veto, the consensus mode becomes a recipe for stalemate. Each SCCR meeting, nevertheless, is time-bound. It must agree to a set of conclusions before midnight of its closing day, even if the unresolved disagreements over policy resurface at the last minute. And I set this up because it explains what happens in, if you can understand, varying meanings of something happening at last November's meeting. There's quite a bit of background to what went on last November, and it started earlier when WIPO adopted a development agenda, basically saying that intellectual property regulations and rules should be adjusted to support development interest in the developing world. In 2008, Ken Cruz, now at Columbia University, did a study of the copyright laws of most of WIPO's member states and showed great variations and lack of library and archives provisions. In 2010, the SCCR expanded its discussion from just library and archives exceptions to look at the needs of visually impaired persons and then combine those together with library, archives, and education. 2011, a 41-nation African group presented a draft WIPO treaty, actually put it on the table, and it's an official document for discussion at SCCR. In November 2011, IFLA, working closely with the Africa group, revised its earlier proposal and came up with something which they call TLIB, which is Treaty on Copyright Exceptions and Limitations for Library and Archives. The TLIB was co-sponsored by the ICA as well as a few other organizations. So there is an archival participation in here. Tim Padfield's been important in that area. In order to deal with all these things, SCCR's meeting last November was expanded from 1 week to two. Exceptions for libraries and archives were the center of attention for much of those that 2 weeks and started off the week in the first week from November 21 to 23. And SAA in that first morning was granted accreditation as an ad hoc observer, meaning we had the right to speak and to attend and so forth. In the first afternoon session, the chair called upon Brazil to present what became known as a background document. And this was basically the substance of the IFLA's consortium's proposal. Yet as a background document, it had no status as draft treaty language, and by itself could not even remain on the agenda for future meetings because it was only a background document. The NGOs who were there, including the archivist and publishers and so forth, were then allowed to give presentations on behalf or, depending their interest, maybe tweaking the treaty so it wasn't so favorable to libraries and archives. We were allowed a presentation of 3 to 5 minutes. And in 3 to 5 minutes, it's very hard to summarize what's really important for the rest of the world relating to the archival dimensions of copyright. But this, and not only that, this is the sole opportunity that the ICA and the SAA had to speak at the committee's meeting. After the NGO comments, a succession of Latin American and African countries praised TWIB as benefiting development in the global south. The U.S. delegate, though, insisted that first, before anything else could be considered, such as the Africa Group's proposal or Brazil's background document, there needed to be general guiding principles. To this end, the next day, the U.S. submitted its objectives and principles for exceptions and limitations for libraries and archives. Essentially, this advocated so-called soft law. In other words, international guidelines for possible exceptions rather than mandatory treaty provisions. And that issue between soft law and mandatory provisions is at the center of the divide between the global north and the global south on this issue. With 4 competing proposals on the table, the chair decided to use a staff-created 17-page comparative table that showed how these various proposals related to each other. In a foreshadowing of what was to come, we saw a quibbling by many of the delegates there over what was in which column and which cell. And you can imagine this could go on forever. Anybody who's been in a committee which, as a committee, tries to write a document. Eventually, the chair set the meeting in somewhat of an imperial way, set the meeting about discussing and debating the issues in a series of clusters. Clusters is a favorite term in WIPO land. And I have on the screen there the areas, rather than reading them off to you, just glance at them. You'll see they deal with some things we're familiar with, such as in terms of library and archives exceptions, such as preservation, interlibrary loan, limitations of liabilities of libraries, technological protection measures that has to do with the need that for preservation purposes we may have to, as a library archives, may have to circumvent copy protection mechanisms that are in a document. The debate on orphan works was troubling. Both sides discussed it only in the context of published books. One delegate even questioned whether a work could ever truly be an orphan. Needless to say, this scenario did not reflect the kinds of orphan works that predominate in archives. A further worrisome sign was that some delegates from countries with strong moral rights provisions suggested that an orphan work could never be released without the permission of its author or heirs because this would abridge the right of first publication. This concern, interestingly enough, came from an otherwise global south, if you will, country that was very supportive of the library and archives exceptions. This, to me, made it very apparent that archivists are going to need to mount a strong ongoing effort to keep orphan works provisions in whatever document moves forward within SCCR. Further, it seemed to me that the moral rights matter could make orphan works exceptions for unpublished materials too controversial for the library advocates to keep this provision for archival material into the whatever document goes forward, unless we're there. Archivists, I don't think, should accept this perspective. Instead, we should use our concern for orphan works as a precondition for our participation in consortia advocating for library and archives exceptions. Meanwhile, we need to begin a multifaceted strategy to neutralize and reframe the issue if we don't want to find one of our most important items thrown off the train. With the diversity of issues covered over the full two-week meeting, the near constant disagreement on the particulars of preliminary documents, and the tendency of delegates to divert debate into procedural matters, we had little hope that the closing day of December the 2nd would see any sudden consensus. In fact, the final day of the meeting had some peculiar features worthy of waiting for Godot. The closing day's purpose is to draft, review, and agree to the all-important statement of conclusions, which reports on the issues discussed, documents created, and the dates and agenda for future SCCR meetings. All of this has to happen before the meeting's mandate ends at midnight. If not, in technical terms, the meeting never existed, and its documents would have no standing for future deliberations. I told you there was drama, but it was of a rather different nature. Inauspiciously, the morning session of the last day didn't begin until shortly before 12 noon, and quickly fell into disagreements over an unrelated matter of broadcast signals. When no consensus emerged after 30 minutes, the chair adjourned the meeting for lunch, during which, in addition to lunch, he was going to meet with various regional groups to try to work out a timetable and a document. Unsurprisingly, we didn't reconvene at the designated 3 o'clock hour, but at 4:30. At that time, however, we received a 3-page draft conclusions that offered something to celebrate. The discussion of library and archives exceptions would be carried forward to the next SCCR meeting, meaning that the November 2011 SCCR would not be dismissed as having never existed. As discussion began, a handful of items were resolved without too much difficulty, but the chair's backroom magic had not been enough to settle all issues. One point proved very controversial, a four-word modifier on an international instrument had been included in square brackets in the draft version of the conclusions. And this was part of the pivotal next steps issue. This seemingly trivial phrase then dogged the meeting late into the evening. Still, the document actually showed that considerable ground had been given by those objecting to library and archives exceptions, since the draft conclusion stated that the earlier compilation document would become the official committee document. This was a major victory for the advocates of the library and archives exceptions, including the ICA and SAA. There remained, of course, the not inconsequential dispute over what the document would be titled. In short, those delegates who argued for soft law objected to the words "an international instrument" because that would concede too much ground to a process they wanted to stop. On the other hand, the treaty advocates saw the phrase as essential for WIPO's 2007 development agenda. Thus, process remained the stalking horse for fundamental political divisions. Without resolution, no consensus would be reached, and the two-week meeting would then have officially not existed. Over the next 4 hours, despite multiple efforts, every reasonable suggestion failed to obtain consensus. Finally, after the translators had gone home and all business had to be conducted in English, the delegates who had been resisting movement on a treaty put forward compromise language that the treaty proponents could accept. That is the paragraph number 4. I won't read it. What is in red was what they came up with instead of those 4 words of "on an international instrument." So what's supposed to be developed is a provisional working document containing comments on and textual suggestions towards an appropriate international legal instrument in whatever form on exceptions and limitations for libraries and archives. Okay. In the context of the day, it was a tremendous achievement for those seeking the exceptions, although the prolixity of the result would hardly seem dramatic. To an outsider, 2 weeks to arrive at an agreement only to continue discussing a provisional working document towards an appropriate instrument in whatever form may not seem terribly significant. However, in the context of the world of WIPO SCCR, this was an amazing step forward. It ensured that the issue of archives and library needs in the digital era will remain before the international body with the ability to draft a treaty to create uniformity and facilitate access via today's technology. Yet it's clear that there is entrenched opposition to any formal treaty requirements, and the document going forward is merely a compilation of sometimes conflicting provisions. Nevertheless, a substantial need for these exceptions has been recognized. As the first occasion for SAA to be represented at an international treaty-making body, it was a great learning experience. WIPO's committee make policy that can have significant consequences for how we do our work. Now we understand how complex the process is. The experience also demonstrates the importance of being involved in advocacy and provides the following lessons. In relationship to orphan works, we should not relent in calling for an orphan works exception for unpublished works merely because the moral rights legal regimes may seem to be a barrier. The right of first release to the public is not one of the moral rights supported by the Berne Convention or TRIPS. With good examples and professional standards, I think we can make a strong case. And I believe it also would help to point out that the rest of the information world is really meandering into the same kind of thing that archivists face on a daily basis. That is, we're the canaries in the coal mine. The problem that archivists face with orphan works is becoming everybody's problem as more and more information is released through the web, but without any continuity on the identity or location of authors. There's other issues, even for American archivists that can rely on Section 108 on library and archives exception. There's other issues in the TLIB proposal that would benefit American archivists and archivists as a whole, especially in the technological protection measures, which it would enact something that is much more liberal than what we see, thanks, unfortunately, to the 1996, what was that thing called? DMCA, 98, actually. If we are unable to continue the archival engagement with the SCCR process, such advances may disappear because favorable elements can be negotiated away. Despite the enormous debt we owe to library organizations, there are differences in our two professions. Only a specific archival advocacy can make our case for our issues in an unqualified way to the national delegates. We need to recognize that the success of IFLA at WIPO is something that's been taking a long time to develop, and at present, archivists do not have the network to build these relations with the delegates IFLA is able to do. If we want to have a role in going forward, and I believe we can, we need clear goals, modest foundation support, and a partnership between SAA and ICA. One thing that really hit me when I was in Geneva was the amazing amount of work that the SAA's Intellectual Property Working Group and SAA Council before it has done on copyright issues. The fact that there were some 20-plus statements from 1994 to the present gives us a very strong basis and authority for how we can speak on these issues. And in fact, it was as the meeting went along, I was able to pull out one of those on best practices for orphan works. That is the ongoing sort of thing we do in the organization that is invaluable for advocacy of any nature, whether it's intellectual property or something else. I also want to comment on one of the things about being the representative there. It was there was superb collaboration of the organizational leadership at 7 hours time difference between Geneva and Chicago, or 6 hours between Geneva and Boston, where I had to contact the president or the executive director of SAA. It was incredibly important to have their support and their ready attention to issues. And there were a couple points at which I had to say, do I have your clear approval to exercise a veto on a joint press release? That sort of thing, if we are going to be active in these in such advocacy efforts, we need to recognize that we can't have a vote by council, even by email or of the executive committee, in the midst of it. Somebody has to be delegated. It was an honor that SAA trusted me to do so, and I hope I did well by them. In conclusion, SCCR 23 demonstrated significant movement But progress is going to take more time, perhaps years, before a treaty document can be shaped to garner the votes of enough countries to move it forward. The obstacles are significant and the challenges may seem intimidating, but as archivists, we have nothing to lose by advocating for amendments to advanced learning and science, and everything to gain. Even if not immediately effective, arguing the case will remind the current and future generations of archivists that certain principles are worth fighting for, even if the odds seem stacked against us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill and David. Those were, boy, on a certain level, it really was gripping, Bill. You know, maybe not, you know, it wasn't a blockbuster, but, you know, it made it through.
It's gripping at a slow
pace. It still came through. So I'd like to open this up for questions. I hope everybody does have questions. And just to remind you, we are being recorded, so I will have to do the repeating of the question. So if you have a very long question, may I please apologize in advance, and we'll make sure that we characterize this appropriately for the recording. So do I have any questions to start us off? Not a question. Oh, come on. Yes, in the back.
Sort of an organizational question. Is SAA, does SAA have a group of people besides Bill and the committee that is able to carry forward this work? Is it grooming the younger generation so that 10 years from now, we still need this type of representation? We've got it.
Well, what we do have is we do have the Intellectual Property Working Group. There are there's 8 members of it. We've been around since 2001. Yeah, the group itself was formed in 2001, and it has fairly stable membership. But we definitely add membership, especially as we see new areas of expertise that we do need it in. All three of us are members of that group, and there are other members throughout, but that is something that we do, and we work very hard, actually, in putting together all of that stuff. And I want to encourage everyone who has not seen our webpage. We have a webpage attached to the SAA main page that includes all of our reports. We also include in it all sorts of different various information about, specifically targeted towards U.S. copyright and other legal issues related to our collection. So, and that'll also give you a list of members. So I'm the current chair, so also if anybody has any questions or anything about the group, please feel free to contact me. But yes, there are a group of us, and we work very hard. Now sometimes, yes, it gets a bit overwhelming, but we do a darn good job of it, I would say. Any further thoughts, Bill?
Maybe Richard has his hand up, and he's going to say what I would say. Richard? That's an excellent and very accurate statement, but it wasn't what I was going to say.
Oh, I was going to say, can I quick summarize that?
Yes.
For the recording? basic summarized comment was that one of the things that is crucial to point out in this is that the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation paid to support SAA's representation at that, and that is the funding of advocacy efforts is one of the big challenges and one of the big things that we have to remember as SAA members. Was that appropriate? Yes.
And what I was going to say is I missed the intellectual property working group meeting on Wednesday, but my understanding from the agenda that I read in advance was the discussion of the possibility of finding some new members to join the committee. I think you have a very good point that troubles me, that because you're exactly right. We need to be looking for the younger generation mm-hmm. of people to be coming on to these issues. If we go back and we look at the World Blind Union has been spending 30 years, God hope that doesn't happen with Library and Archives exceptions, of going to WIPO. But we have intellectual property issues that have been going on in SAA for several years, and we are going to need many new people coming in over the coming years.
Can I just add one? Mm-hmm. Clearly, it's extremely expensive and difficult to fundraise in order to send an individual to Geneva for these extended periods of time that these SCCR meetings take. And yet it's absolutely essential that there should continue to be an archival voice there present. These meetings are comparatively frequent as well. They just roll on and on and on, SCCR 23, SCCR 24, SCCR 25, and so on, and things very often get left on to be continued in the next meeting. One of the things that I'd really like to offer on behalf of the International Council on Archives, given our experience is showing that there's no significant differences in the representations that we wish to make and that SAA wishes to make, it really should be the case that if SAA is not able to send a representative to a particular meeting, then ICA should redouble its efforts to be present at that meeting, and then if at the following meeting ICA is not able to be present, then if SAA can be there, so much the better, and we can dovetail and share both experience and information and also cost in that way. And the more that SAA and ICA work in partnership on ensuring this archival voice over there in Geneva, the more I'll be pleased.
Thank you. And thank you for your excellent question. Yes, another hand there in the white cardigan. Okay, let me repeat the question first. Okay, prepare your answer while I repeat the question. You let me know if I do it right. Her question is relating to a collection that her repository has put together, and they are going to be digitizing it and putting it up on the web. And the crux of her question is, if she's putting it up on the web here in the United States and we have a particular period of time for protection, what is the effect of the different lengths of protection in other countries, and what about ensuring that people cite their collection appropriately?
It's an incredibly complex question. I think what you have to do is to engage in a risk management assessment of the digitization project that you're going to do. It's well known that there are certain literary estates around the world which are particularly dangerously litigious. And if any of those people are represented in your collections, then be very careful. If you're dealing with comparatively low-profile individuals within the collection, then your risk management, which needs to be signed off by the legal representatives within your institution, the risk management should indicate that the risk is comparatively low. If you've complied with all the legislation within your own country and put in all the necessary disclaimers and waivers and indications of good faith, then I don't think that people who wish to digitize should be paralyzed by concerns about what legal actions might be considered in other countries. But be very careful of the 2, 3, 4 dozen estates around the world who just love going into courtrooms. That makes life an awful lot easier as well. The legal representatives of your institution should read over your risk assessment of what you propose to do, but it sounds to me as though in the particular case you're on fairly safe ground.
Hey, yeah, right up front here.
It seems to me that there are so archives are starting to put things like databases, which have a very tenuous copyright situation internationally, as I understand it. Is there any guide or is there any sort of help out there for archivists that are dealing with databases that might have copyrights on them or European database rights or anything like that?
Okay, this next question is regarding if there is any guidance out there for archivists who are working with databases, especially those because the database law, the copyright in databases, is so tenuous and is very different throughout the world.
If the portion of the question about am I aware of anything to go for guidance on there, no simple tool. No particular place there. And when we think about databases, it's complicated in several ways insofar as there are data within the database that are simple facts that don't involve expression. There's nothing copyrightable about that. The structure, the arrangement, any interpretation of the data could be subject to copyright. And that's that distinction between that it's expression that's where copyright resides is something which is not just a fundamental principle of American law, but it is fundamental to the Berne Convention as well. That said, database protection law, as you note, has been is something which has been enacted in the European Union, or directive, I should say, and it is not something which has been enacted in U.S. law. The other guidance I would put forward with the great caution that any simple rule is going to can get you into trouble very quickly, but that what you have to follow in the U.S. is U.S. law. And your exposure to the laws of other countries will be dependent upon how much business you're doing in that country so that you have assets that then can then be exposure better. Menzi could probably explain this a little bit better, but and just as with the instance that I think David was anticipating with the prior question about certain authors being particularly litigious, if your databases are science and engineering databases that European company such as Elsevier happens to have an ownership in, you want to be a lot more careful about disseminating those. If it's databases that are data accumulated by scientific researchers at your institution in the States, then I think your risk factor has to be a little bit lower. But that's the best I can give you for quick guidance.
Other question? Oh, yes. Sorry.
Thinking through David, your initial illustration, I want to ask a question to help clarify what you're trying to say.
Okay, so to attempt to summarize the question, you let me know, Christian, if I get this right. The heart of the question is, in the examples that relate to the location and the ownership of particular literary manuscripts, so for example, the Wolfe manuscripts, where some of them are in New York and some of them are at the University of Sussex, and as a result, they have different, some of them are in copyright and some of them aren't. At what point is it the location or is it the ownership that determines where the copyright, whether or not things are in copyright? Over to you, Dave.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart for that wonderful question. It's an incredible. The 70-year copyright period for unpublished works in the United States came in only in 2003, and so people are still finding their way through all of the complications that ensue from that, particularly in respect of the papers of UK authors which are held in the USA. There are very many such split collections. D.H. Lawrence papers similarly in Texas and in Nottingham, where different copyright legislations apply in the two countries. A number of things influence the effect that this can have. First and foremost is the value. If an author and the potential publication of an author has a big price tag attached to it, then you have to pay much more legal attention to what's being done, because you can find yourself legally challenged. If an author is of comparatively little financial interest, then again, in terms of the risk assessment, you're taking much, much less of a risk. The legal implications and ramifications of all of this are still being worked out. My understanding is that when people are going for joint US-UK publication of a UK literary author, the publishers work it out amongst themselves as to how they can abide by the legislations of the two different countries. As for going it alone type of publication, I've never heard any suggestion that the Sussex manuscripts could in some way be transported to a US location, especially for the purpose of benefiting from US copyright law or anything like that. I think the full legal ramifications of this distinction in copyright have not been tested at law in any case that I'm aware of, any high-profile case. It comes down, from the archivist's point of view, it will come down to a risk assessment, and from the publisher's point of view, they will normally get their legal departments to work out where they're going to distribute the work and whether they have to work in more than one national legislation in order to make the work publishable.
Well, we're actually a little bit above time, so I want to thank everybody for even staying a couple of minutes late to listen to the questions. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your time in San Diego. Thank you.